He is prolific and provocative and always a pleasure to talk with on Air Talk, Michael Shermer, who one of the hats he wears is coming in regularly to talk with us about the top science stories. He's, of course, the founder and director of the Skeptic Society, publisher of Skeptic Magazine, and columnist for Scientific American. But in addition to that, he is a prolific author. And his latest book, just out, is The Mind of the Market, Compassionate Apes, Competitive Humans, and Other Tales from Evolutionary Economics, published by Times Books. Michael, great to have you with us.
Oh,
we
thanks
appreciate
for having me
it.
Again. Yes, good to be back.
You've given us a little bit of a tease on this on previous segments, talking about brain imaging and research into economic behavior. This is the book gives you a chance to synthesize a lot of this to try and understand how we've evolved and in that evolution, how we look at money and economic issues.
Yeah, The Mind of the Market does, it comes at it from two levels. One is descriptive, in which I describe the way people actually behave in the marketplace. Turns out we're just as irrational there as we are in all other aspects of life. So there's sort of a continuity from what I've always done, the study of human irrationality. But it's also prescriptive. That is, I think we can actually make some suggestions about how corporations should interact with the customers and how governments should structure societies to allow a certain amount of freedom, but not too much freedom. And so to that extent, then I'm integrating at those two levels, three different sciences, behavioral economics, neuroeconomics, and evolutionary economics. And no one's done this before in one package.
Now, you are of a libertarian bent, and I think of libertarianism as believing that the free market is inherently, in its rationality, enables the best decisions to be made. People operate in their own interests. Those competing interests play out with progress. But here, what we see in research is that people often defeat their own self-interest.
They do. And so I've learned a lot about my own beliefs and had to knock back some of my libertarian tendencies simply because the data points otherwise. In other words, the libertarian perspective, small ill libertarian in this case, not the party, but just right. Sort of classical liberalism, does depend on what's called homo economicus. That is, economic man is rational when he makes choices and free when we make choices, and that we maximize our utility. So the three things are: we make rational choices that we are freely entered into, and we maximize our utility, or we make selfish decisions that just benefit ourselves. Well, the data shows all three of these are false. So now, whether we should allow free markets to be free, that's sort of a political decision. But if you're basing it strictly on theory, the theory falls before the data. So for example, you walk into a store, and there's, they say, a $100 iPod for sale, and somebody says, hey, four blocks down the street, it's on sale, half off, $50. Would you make the walk?
Sure. Who wouldn't?
You're in the same store, you're buying a $1,000 flat-screen TV, somebody says, hey, four blocks down the street, they got it on sale, $50 off, $950. Why bother? Yeah. So it's the same $50, and yet that's not an absolute value, it's a relative value, relative to the frame it's in, the frame being 1,000 versus 100. So, of course, this is how automobile dealerships get away with a $35,000 car. What's a $500 extra widget on the stereo, or
the alarm system with all the bells and whistles,
exactly.
Literally.
You would never spend $800 just at the drop of a hat, and yet compared to $35,000, oh, what the heck.
Of course I'll get the clear coat.
the true coat,
not the phony one. The other thing I find fascinating is this drive to be treated equitably. We have a real easily triggered sense of being taken advantage of.
We do. So this famous ultimatum game, as it's called, so two subjects in an experiment, let's say they're poor starving students in a lab, which is typically how these things are done, they could really use the money. You give one of them $100 and say, you have to make an offer to the other subject of whatever split you want, 50-50, 60-40, 80-20, 90-10, whatever you think is best. And if he accepts the offer, you both get to keep the money, and if he rejects the offer, I'm taking it back, and the experiment's over, you get nothing. Now, according to homo economicus theory, the person making the donation or the offer should offer something like a 90-10. He's going to be selfish. He's going to maximize his own utility, get as much as he can. And the person receiving the offer should accept the $10.
Because $10 he wouldn't have otherwise.
$10 he wouldn't. He's going to walk out of here with nothing. Hey, get a free $10. Inevitably, they turn down the $10. And they turn it down with a sense of great unfairness, disgust, anger. And when you ask why, you could have had. Now, see, an economist would say he's willing to pay $10 to punish this other subject.
Or to not feel bad that he's a lesser person because he got 10%.
That's right. So we're willing to pay money to adjust and correct for unfair inequitable redistributions of goods and services. And this appears to be a deeply ingrained evolutionary sense, because you can do the same experiment with primates. So two chimps or two capuchin monkeys sitting at a desk here in two cages, and they both have to pull a rope. When they pull a rope, a platform comes up the side of the desk, and on the platform is a bucket of ice with freshly cut fruit, which they like, and like poor starving students, they haven't eaten in a while, so they're motivated. And but only one of them, if they both pull the rope up, the platform comes up evenly, but the bucket is over on one side, and only one of them gets the food. If he shares the food, the second time they do it, both of them pull it up, and it all goes well. But if he doesn't share the food with the other primate, then things go very bad. he refuses to play again. He won't pull the rope. He gets mad. They throw things. Now, they don't have a language module in their brain to say, hey, that was not right, or he's a bastard for not sharing properly. But they show it emotionally. So the emotions evolved, I argue, in the mind of the market, that we evolved these emotions to as a proxy for correcting behavior, for resolving social conflict, for enforcing the rules of proper social exchange. And so here's where the evolutionary economics thing comes in, that we evolved in these hunter-gatherer communities over millions of years, or at least hundreds of thousands of years, and those communities were largely of kin and kind, people we know or related to. There's only a couple dozen to a couple hundred individuals. It's a resource-poor environment, not much stuff. So these are very egalitarian societies, and there's a lot of pressure for redistributions of goods. That's why we have this sense of fairness.
Fascinating. And as we continue, I'm also interested in how much of it is emotional and how much is an evolutionary drive not to be left behind. And we're, even if we get something, we don't want to be left behind our peers. We'll continue with Michael Shermer, his book, The Mind of the Market, Compassionate Apes, Competitive Humans, and Other Tales from Evolutionary Economics. This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Michael Shermer, the skeptic, his latest book, The Mind of the Market, following up on the science of good and evil, looking at how our brains process economic decisions and what the implications of that are for our larger society and government policy. We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. So is this drive to be treated fairly, do you think it's a kind of evolutionary push to compete in a sense? We don't want to feel that we're left behind because we feel that our very existence is somehow jeopardized by that. Or is it just an emotional thing that it just hurts our feelings and we don't do well with that?
Well, in a way, it's both, because what are emotions? Our brains have emotions, and these are neurons firing, and neurons are expensive to run. Brains are expensive to run. So emotions are there for a reason. And if we take something simple like thirst or hunger, and think of the body as a homeostatic system that's constantly slightly out of balance, and we're constantly behaving or moving or acting in the world to correct that balance. You're thirsty, you drink, you're hungry, you get animals, including us, we get more active when we're hungry until you're absolutely starving and passing out. But you become more active because it's a way of motivating the organism to get up and look around, look for some calories. So the emotion of thirst or hunger is just a proxy for get out there and get some calories. Now, turns out there's no satiation module as well for foods that are extremely rich in fat and sugar, because in a resource-poor environment like the Paleolithic environment in which we evolved, those foods were at once both valuable and rare, so get as much of it as you can. This is why we have this idea. I mean, in a way, money is a proxy for stuff in our environment, and stuff in our environment is pretty rare in resource-poor environments. I mean, if you walked into a Yanomamo village or any hunter-gatherer village anywhere in the world before 10,000 years ago, or even the few that are around today, there's only about 300 items within an order of magnitude, just a couple hundred items, food products, tools, things like that. Not much. So anything you can get, you endow with a lot of value, you hang on to. And so in our natural world, of course, we have unlimited choices, unlimited foods and so on, and our brains are not well adjusted to that. So we get overwhelmed with choices, for example. You walk down the supermarket, there's 57 types of toothpaste. I'm just, paralyzed, called analysis paralysis, just too much, because our brains are simply not well designed for that. So What I'm arguing is that that sense of fairness comes from the fact that these egalitarian societies, any social primate species, has to have some means of getting along well through conflict resolution, for equitable redistribution, especially food sharing, and these emotions of, like, what is anger? Anger is a way of expressing your dislike at a unfair offer, the breach of a social contract, an arrangement we had, whether it's a cuckolding in a relationship or a business relationship gone bad. Anger is an expressive emotion in a social species to adjust for that, to let everybody know, to send a signal that's not okay to do that, and you better not do it again. And that's a constant adjustments to keep things relatively equal, which is why I think we have this deep resentment of wealthy people like Bill Gates. There's this IHateBillGates.com webpage. I mean, and there's this sense that even
it's unfair. A sense of that it, yeah, that it's like, not
fairness. There's just too much. And let's be honest, throughout all of evolutionary history, and especially the history of civilization, people that were extremely well off, their gains probably were best described as ill-gotten. And it's only really in the most recent, maybe in the last century and a half or so, that you really could get wealthy in a fairly fair and reasonable way by offering a better product and doing what, say, somebody like a Bill Gates or Warren Buffett did. And this is why we have even now an interesting social pressure for those guys to give it all back, and that they seek status in so doing.
I think, though, you could argue that, certainly in the case of Bill Gates and many of these others, there is still a ruthlessness required in it. There is still the thing that goes even beyond competition into, you know, wanting to just to grab every share of the market, to get every, there is that kind of a drive, and I think that also fuels that resentment. There's a feeling that the victory or the success comes at the expense of someone else.
I think that, I think that's probably right, that there's competing motives. We are selfish, greedy, nasty, competitive, and so on, but we're also pro-social, cooperative, altruistic, and giving, and there's that constant tension. So the goal here is, how do we structure our political system and our economic system to attenuate the nasty, greedy stuff and accentuate the positive? So one of the myths I'm correcting in the myth of the mind of the market is that most people have an idea of what I call the Gordon Gekko theory of capitalism, that everybody in capitalism is like greed is good and Gordon Gekko, and that just can't be right, because the companies like Enron then would all implode. There has to be a certain balance between being self-driven and then also being fair in your dealings with others. And of course, that's why we have all these rules about how even the free market shouldn't be completely free. We have to have certain constraints on it. So like athletes who dope, for example, I mean, you have to have a set of rules that are enforced, or else every athlete will just try to better himself any way he can.
Yeah, some athletes will go so far as even if they know they're going to die a few years later, yeah, if they could win a gold medal, they'd make the sacrifice.
That's right. That was Montgomery's famous statement. If he fell over dead on the other side of the thing, but he won the gold medal, he'd be happy. Well, so there's enough companies like that, we do need to have some constraints on the market. So the balance, the rub here is the balance in a liberal democracy and a market economy, and what the balance is between how much freedom to give. So, for example, I like the idea of carbon credit trading. You know, we as a liberal democracy decide we're only going to allow this much carbon into the atmosphere because of this global warming problem. But you guys sort it out.
Work it out amongst yourselves,
because the market is very effective at solving those kinds of problems.
Michael Shermer with us. His new book, The Mind of the Market, Compassionate Apes, Competitive Humans, and Other Tales from Evolutionary Economics. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Gail and Palos Verdes, you're on Air Talk.
Hey, guys. This is a great conversation, and I'm going to go out and buy the book. I would like to talk about developmental psychology and the whole idea that I'm actually a clinical social worker, and I'm always counseling people that when they're children, you know, in their sibling group, there's so much conflict about the fairness, was I loved equally. And I'm always telling people that's a myth. That you can't be loved equally, you might be loved differently. And I think that in our culture there's, you know, we live with this myth of equally divided love from our parents, and it makes us uber competitive and uber sensitive to fairness.
Because we feel slighted more easily. Do you think there's a cultural component, Michael?
Yeah, of course, definitely, sure. I mean, I guess one of the other points I'm making in the mind of the market is that, yes, of course, culture influences us heavily. We're buffeted about by these various forces, our parents, our siblings, peer groups, and so on, and we have a great capacity for learning. But let's not discount the 99.9% of our history we spent as these hunter-gatherers in our evolutionary past. That surely has some effect on our thinking. So another one of these thought experiments that are kind of fun to play called the trolley car problem. So there's a track coming down the train. You're standing there at the switch where the track splits. Down one side of the tracks where the train is about to go, there's five workers who will be killed. Down the other side of the track is one worker. If you throw the switch, the train will go down to the left and kill him. So do you throw the switch? And most people say, well, yeah, rational calculation, kill one to save five. Yes, I'd throw the switch. Second scenario, there's a track train coming down, a single track, five workers on the track, no split in the track. And it's just about to kill the five workers. You're on a bridge over the track, and standing next to you is a great big guy. Would you throw him off? When he lands on the track, he's hit by the train, stops the train, saves the five workers. Would you kill one to save five? It's the exact same moral calculation, and almost everybody says no.
One's direct.
Yeah.
One's if you're taking the physical action to make it happen.
Almost everybody says they wouldn't do it. And when you ask them why, they give that, oh, it's, well, you know, it doesn't seem right to push somebody. I mean, some people ask, well, who is it? No. Depends who it is. So, I mean, there is a deep sense of, you know, direct versus non-direct, human versus non-human, our group versus somebody else's group. We do make distinctions between things. And so much of our evolution is this in-group, out-group morality. Within groups, we tend to be very fairly pro-social, cooperative, and so on. It's the between groups, between strangers, where things get dicier with xenophobia, natural tribalism, hostilities between groups. And one of the best social tools ever developed is trade. Now, we think of an economy as markets and money, but think of an economy as any social environment in which organisms are exchanging something or interacting in some way. When chimp A grooms chimp B, yes, there's a hygienic thing where you get the ticks and lice off or whatever, and yes, there's a little bit of a bonding or attachment that goes on between them. But one more step, there's a political alliance there. When alpha male attacks one of those two chimps, the other one is more likely to come to his aid if they've been grooming each other.
Mm-hmm.
So grooming is a form of exchange. Mm-hmm. I'll do this for you. Literally, I'll scratch your back if you come to my political aid in a little alliance against the big bad guy. And this is true for hunter-gatherers. I mentioned the Yanomamo people that Napoleon Chagnon studied, and he has in his book this whole business of how they trade, and especially they do this reciprocal feasting, where I throw a big potlatch for you, they call it that, but you throw one for me. Why would they do this? I mean, it's costly, it's expensive, can't afford it, it's kind of risky. Well, but when Village C comes around to attack that's more powerful, the two of us can get together. It decreases inter-village violence between the two trading groups, and it increases political alliance against other more dangerous groups. So the Yanomamo are trading not because they're innate altruists or nascent capitalists. They're doing it for selfish political reasons. But the byproduct is they're less likely to fight between themselves, and they get more stuff. They get more products, more distribution of goods.
So would you use this to make an argument in favor of globalism?
I would, yes, of course. That I call this Bastiat's principle, where goods do not cross frontiers, armies will. And then my Starbucks corollary is that where Starbucks cross frontiers, or where goods do cross frontiers, armies will not. Now, it's not perfect. It's, you know, there's no perfect laws in social science, but it's a first approximation that, well, look what happens when two countries get angry at each other. What's the first thing we do? We impose economic sanctions against Cuba, against North Korea, against China, against Iran. Now, we've lifted them from China largely. But it's a signal sent to another group, say, we don't like what you're doing, and we're not going to trade with you anymore. Yes, but that's a prelude to something even worse, which is often war. Not always, but often.
So what is the argument in terms of diplomacy, our international relations? Is there a way beyond just commerce of building these kinds of sense of commonalities and partnerships with other countries? Because you know, a lot of people dismiss diplomacy as, mm-hmm. as sort of empty-headed, feel-good, but not bearing of fruit. Can you do it in ways that aren't just economic alliances?
Well, I guess the difficult thing there is that, you know, I would always encourage more trade, but if it's largely unilateral, then it may not work. That is, we have to have exchange in both directions. These, you know, these fair trade, free trade type agreements we struggle to enter into. And I mean, one of the great things Adam Smith did was he said, look, it's counterintuitive to think this, but the wealth of a nation is in all the consumers, not the handful of producers. And our whole system is structured to protect the producers from foreign producers, because we're thinking that's how we make a nation wealthy. In the wealth of nations, he said, no, the wealth is in all the people and all the stuff they have. So, but really, mercantilism is really just economic tribalism. It's saying we want to protect our producers against that other tribe's producers. But really, we should be more concerned with our consumers. And we still practice this today. Even Mr. Laissez-faire Ronald Reagan went and saved the Harley-Davidson motorcycle company. to the point where all of us, I remember because I had a Honda 175 motorcycle, and the price went up 100% for the first 5 years of his tariff program. Why? Millions of American consumers have to pay twice as much for a motorcycle simply to save a couple hundred or a couple thousand employees in the Harley-Davidson production company. That's a producer-driven economy.
Politically driven, too.
Politically driven, yeah. And you still hear what was Romney saying in Michigan, you know, I will protect American automobile workers' jobs. But at what cost? That means that all of us have to pay more for our automobiles.
For maybe a few thousand jobs.
For a few thousand jobs. That you may say, okay, yes, but I want my tribe. Yeah, okay, our tribe is better than their tribe. That is a basic human emotion. But counterintuitively, we'll all actually be wealthier if we don't do that.
Michael Shermer with us, author of The Mind of the Market, Compassionate Apes, Competitive Humans, and Other Tales from Evolutionary Economics. I have to ask you about bubbles in the economy, because we're coming out of the subprime. We had the dot-com before that. And it's fascinating to me how this irrational exuberance takes hold. And you have people who are saying, you know, very logical critiques of the bubble as it's building up. But the momentum seems to be there, and it's like nothing can stop it from happening.
Yep. This is one of the great counterexamples to conspiracy theories. You know, I thought it was just 12 guys running the economy. That was Bush and Cheney and the Illuminati and the Rockefellers and Rothschilds and Bilderbergers, and they control it. Obviously, they don't control it. The mind of the market. My other usage is the market has a mind of its own, and there's not much we can do about it. And this whole idea of a tax rebate for, you know, $300 for every American or whatever it is, that's been done before. It has no effect at all, so I'm not sure why they're doing it, other than politicians feel like they're supposed to do something when everybody's up in arms about it. The fact is that that there's just going to be a boom and bust cycle, never as big as it used to be, but the analogy I make is it's like the global warming curve. It's going up, the stock market, let's say, in real estate. Say, take the last 70 years. It's going up. It will keep going up. It will always go up. With little downturns, like it gets cool once in a while, then it gets warm, but the overall trend is going up. And so I'm not one for making predictions, especially about the future, as Yogi Berra said, but, you know, don't sell just on that. I mean, sell stocks because the company is not valued anymore or whatever, but don't sell simply just to bail. That's what's causing the sort of problem in the first place, is everybody bailing.
But as you're talking about our earlier hunter-gatherer society, you know, it shows you again how trust is so intrinsic a component for anything, you know, from the stock market to lending practices. Because again, now you've got lenders, for example, afraid to loan money except,
yes,
you know,
right,
to absolute sure thing. They've whipsawed in the opposite direction. And
right,
it shows you again how you trust or lack of trust drives so much of this.
Society has to be structured in such a way that people trust. That's how strangers can trade between strangers is one way of creating trust. Trust in a political system and a sound economy and so on creates, lubricates the trade. You've had my friend Paul Zak on before with his studies of oxytocin, that when this sort of feel good bonding attachment type hormone that strangers are trading with one another, the levels of oxytocin goes up. When he gives them a little hit of oxytocin through a nose spray, they trade more, they're more generous. Not that I'm suggesting we, you know, bombard Wall Street with oxytocin, although it's not a bad idea.
Probably a lot of places where that would come in handy.
But Walmart will be doing this soon, I'm sure.
The generic Walmart brand. Michael, thanks so much. We appreciate your joining us. And folks can come out this coming Wednesday night, the 30th, and see you at All Saints Episcopal Church.
Well, thanks for having me, Larry.
Michael Shermer, The Mind of the Market, his brand new book, Compassionate Apes, Competitive Humans, and Other Tales from Evolutionary Economics.